It's our mind. We may not know everything going on in it, but it's basically ours. We should take ownership of it, and it's there to help us get what we want and do what we want to do.
That's John Barge, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. John Barge is a social and cognitive psychologist and the world's leading expert on the unconscious mind. He joins us to talk about his book, Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Dan, thanks for having me on.
You know, this book is filled with fascinating information, and obviously we don't have time to cover it all in the brief interview space that we have. So give us an overview of this book. Tell us what readers will find here, and then we'll hit some of the highlights.
Well, we have for the first time 30 or 40 years of actual science on what's going on unconsciously in the human mind. And we had speculation and theories in the past, like, for example, of course, most famously, Freud. Freud's theory is based on basically mentally ill people, case studies of his mental patients. And it wasn't really full sent to scientific scrutiny and scientific tests. So now we have last 30 or 40 years of psychological science, cognitive science. We have the methods, the technology, and the techniques to actually get at what are the unconscious influences on how we think and we feel and we do. And it's not just from my lab, it's from labs around the world. And so this is the whole point of the book, is to present that new evidence that we really have for the first time in history.
So you've touched upon this already, but the book has been described as paradigm shifting. So tell us a little bit more about that. How does this go beyond what had been described before in terms of the unconscious mind?
Well, the basic idea here is that we all remember this movie Inside Out from a couple of years ago. It's a very popular animated movie, and it had the four or five emotions at the control center of the mind. And when a little emotion did something wrong and got thrown into a deep, dark cave of a room, and the door was locked, and it was called the unconscious, and you never heard from that little emotion anymore. So this is not what's going on. This is not a dark, separate mind, a dark box where we can never get access to what's going on in there. And it's not malevolent, you know, from principles of natural selection and adaptation and evolution. You know, how could such a malevolent, self-destructive mind have survived the process of, adaptation and natural selection? So what we really have found was that we have a variety of unconscious influences on us, and they're basically helpful. They're basically, they were there to help us meet our goals and needs, survive, reproduce, basically cooperate with each other. It's not a dark cavern of demonic kinds of influences on us at all. So that's really the basic shift. It's our mind. We may not know everything going on in it, but it's basically ours. We should take ownership of it, and it's there to help us get what we want and do what we want to do.
I want to talk to you about how we can use our unconscious mind to our advantage in just a few moments. But first of all, I want to have you share some of the stories in the book about how the unconscious mind shapes our behavior in surprising ways. For example, you write that someone is more likely to be a germaphobe if they are politically conservative.
Yeah, it might be the other way around, but they're definitely related. People who are very concerned about physical safety are more likely to be conservative than people who are not as concerned, but we all are concerned. It's the most important need we have to be safe and to survive. We can't do anything else if we're not alive, so that's very important for all of us. But there's differences in how important it is, and there's a difference in how important things like germs and avoiding disease and contamination are to people. Some people are more worried about that than others are. And it tends to be the people who are more concerned with physical cleanliness and avoiding germs who tend to be more conservative. And that's just sort of historic. But it's interesting because you can certainly cause anybody to be more concerned. For example, when we have like we have in the fall, we're all supposed to get our flu shots. And we're all supposed to worry about, you know, washing our hands or using antibacterial like Purell and to be clean and avoid germs. And so we're really all focused on that. When you remind people of the chance of getting a virus or getting germs from touching things that other people have, like doorknobs and whatever, they become more against immigration. And when you have people get their flu shot or actually give them a chance to wash their hands, they actually become more positive towards immigration. So how in the world does that connect? It connects because you hear our political leaders, but you hear people in general use a metaphor that's very powerful that compares immigrants coming into our country as analogous to germs coming into our body. And so we have to protect ourselves against them. We have to build walls. We have to get rid, expel the people who are already here. It's very much an analogy that plays into our very deep and very powerful and very, very adaptive need to avoid physical disease and avoid contamination by germs. Unfortunately, that metaphor playing unconsciously causes us to react to these issues, these social issues like immigration, as if people were germs, you know, or as if people were viruses. And of course, I think most of us would not really want to do that and have our attitudes based on that kind of idea. But that's what is important about understanding these things operating unconsciously, because consciously we would not ever think that. But unconsciously, that's the analogy, and that's the basis for our strong visceral reaction against immigrants coming into our country.
So is the flip side of that also work? If you feel more secure and safe, do you tend to be a little more liberal in your thinking?
Absolutely. That's other studies we've done have actually had people imagine themselves being physically safe, totally physically safe, like a superpower, like Superman. Bullets bounce off of you. If you fall, nothing cuts you, nothing hurts you. And if people really get into that and imagine a genie has given them the superpower of being totally immune from physical harm, their social attitudes actually shift and become more liberal. And we've actually shown that conservatives who are self-reported conservatives who vote Republican, for example, and other proxies, and of course have big differences between them and liberals or Democrats in social issues like same-sex marriage or legalization of marijuana or whatever, the usual ones that you get these big differences on. After they've imagined themselves being physically safe in this way, they actually have attitudes very similar to liberals. So you can move a conservative, temporarily, of course, right, a conservative to be more liberal by having them feel more safe. And you can also, a lot of research has shown, you can move liberals to be more conservative in their attitudes by threatening them and making them feel fearful.
I'm talking with John Barge. His book is Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. One of the examples you give in your book is about holding a hot cup of coffee and how that makes us think of other people as being friendlier. Tell us about that.
It's a similar kind of thing to the underlying physical safety and disease avoidance. It's another very primal kind of need we have. Back in the day, you know, before there was central heating, and we all take it for granted now, but in a lot of the world, too, still, people really have to worry about being warm at night and staying warm. Our body has a very narrow range of temperature that it functions well in, and we have to make sure that we're not too cold and seek out sources of warmth. So we're talking about back in the day of evolutionary time before there was buildings and central heat and that kind of thing. It was really, really important for the little infant just after birth to stay close to its caretakers. And of course, mothers with breastfeeding and nourishment, that was a source of food. And these two things are actually conflated. The idea of physical warmth, being held close to the body and feeding, is also an experience of physical warmth. And what we've got together here is a person who's socially warm to you. And that's a person you can trust, who has your interests at heart, that's generous and watches out for you, and you can trust and count on. That's what social warmth means. And it's associated so strongly early in life with physical warmth. And so you have this channel, this connection between physical warmth and social warmth. And people have said, well, you know, it's interesting that you would sort of associate trust and generosity with physical warmth, but that's what happens to us as infants, and that's what happened to us over evolutionary time, which leads to research of the last 10 years, which is fascinating to me, because when we did our coffee study, we had people just briefly hold a cup of hot coffee or iced coffee, just incidentally, while we were getting their papers, their questionnaires for them to fill out. They didn't know that was anything to do with the experiment at all. But if they'd held the warm coffee, they rated the person in forming an impression of them as more socially warm, more trusting, more generous, more kind, and that kind of thing. If they'd held the iced coffee, it was just the opposite. They thought the person was less trustworthy, less generous, less socially, more like socially cold. And just because of the physical experience of warmth and coldness. So now what we have is neuroscience has shown it's actually a part of the human brain called the insula, which is about the shape of a walnut, and it's right in the middle of your brain. And there's actually a connection there, that the same little area of that insula becomes active in imaging studies when you hold something warm and when you text to your family and friends. So when you're thinking about the people who you're close to, your close relationships, that same little area is active as when you're holding something warm. And also, there's another area very close to it that if you're betrayed, someone takes your money and doesn't give it back to you or violates your trust, it becomes active. That's socially cold and betrayal. And also, the same area becomes active if you hold something cold. So we have actually in the human brain a physical connection in the brain between physical cold or warm and social cold and warm. And a lot of people think it's because of this experience that infants have all, you know, all over the world. This is all human nature. It's not just, you know, some countries or cultures and not others. But we have this hard connection. And it leads to me giving this little piece of advice. You know, I knew about this when my daughter, she's now 11, but when she was born. And it's so important to hug and hold your infants and your toddlers close to you. So they experience the physical warmth of being held close to you. It creates a bond, a natural way to create a bond. The infant doesn't have any experience, doesn't know anything about the world. It's just been born. But there's just a natural automatic reaction that causes them to bond with the person who's holding them physically warm and close.
Going back to the whole idea of the coffee, it's fascinating to me because there are people that I'm sure all of us know that come into the office in the morning, and you might be one of them, that say, you know, I've got to have that cup of coffee in the morning before I feel human, before I can deal with the world.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like they were right.
They were right. I've always done that. I'm sure millions of people have always done that. When I have guests and visitors to my office, I always offer them a cup of coffee. And here's the funny thing, you know, I think we know this, right? I think we know this in an implicit kind of background way. We sort of knew this. It's surprising to see the science and see this actually demonstrated. But I think we knew this. I was watching the History Channel about, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and there was a documentary on hell. And they have a lot of those in the History Channel for some reason. It was about Dante's Inferno, and I'm watching this. And yeah, on the different levels, and it goes down to the lowest level of hell, which is the ninth. That's the worst sin of all. Turns out, for Dante, the worst sin of all was to be betrayed by a close friend. Not just betrayed by anybody, but betrayed by a friend who violates your trust. And that's exactly what social coldness is. The cold person would betray their mother, you know, would betray their friends for their own personal gain. That's so cold. But how does Dante punish those sinners at the lowest level for being betraying a person's trust? In the middle of fiery hell, it's to be frozen in ice. And for Dante, it was the contrapasso, the punishment that fit the crime. Poetic justice comes from Dante, the idea of poetic justice. And his poetic punishment for someone who was socially cold in that extreme way was to be physically frozen in ice forever.
Well, let's talk a bit about how we can use this knowledge to our advantage. For example, willpower is a big thing. You know, we make big New Year's resolutions, etc., but we have trouble keeping those. How can our unconscious mind help us exhibit more willpower?
Yeah, I devote the last chapter of Before You Know It exactly to this idea that we do have mind control. We do have, once we know how these things operate, we can use them to our advantage. One key unconscious influence on us all the time are triggers of what to do from the outside world called priming. There's like reminders or links to what we want to do from the outside and trigger those things in us. Well, we can make use of those. And one fantastic way to get something done that you're having trouble getting done, it's a difficult intention that you keep meaning to do and you keep forgetting to do. For example, I sometimes borrow books from colleagues, and sometimes they want them. They need them for a paper they're writing, and they ask me to bring them in, and I keep coming into the office, and I forgot to bring it into them, and they get a little upset after a while, and I feel really bad. I keep forgetting. Well, what an implementation intention does is it's a way to take this unconscious influence of the outside world and trigger what you want to get done. It works really well. It's been used in nursing homes. It's helped people go out to vote in primary elections. It does all these great things when people want to do something, but they're having trouble doing it. And it's so simple. All you have to do is link what you want to do to a very dependable, reliable future event, something you know is going to happen. So in my case, with the book, I told myself, when I get home and I walk into my apartment, this is when I lived in New York City, and worked at NYU, when I get home and I walk into my apartment, I will immediately go to that book and put it in my briefcase. So, you know, the next day when I bring my briefcase into work, the book will be in there and I'll have it, and I'll have it in the office. I find myself, you forget about this, you know, I forgot all about the book, I forgot this intention completely. I walk into my apartment, which is dark. I walk in the dark all the way to my bedroom, which I never do, and I'm standing in front of the book. And this is the kind of effect it is. It's like you specify the trigger in the outside world, and when that event happens, you will do something you found difficult to do. And you could even forget that intention. But when that event happens, it triggers in your mind what you wanted to get done. And that technique has helped elderly patients in nursing homes take all the different pills that they have to take at different times of day, and with food, without food. It really increases their adherence rate to their medical regimens, which is a life or death matter to them, and all these other good effects. And it doesn't rely on willpower, except that you really want to get it done and you make this intention, which is the willpower part. But instead of having to remember when we often forget, it really helps trigger these things that we want to do anyway, but sort of takes the load off of us and has it happen naturally.
John Barger's book is Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. John, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Dan.
More interviews on a wide variety of topics are available at kpr.ku.edu/conversations. You'll find us on Facebook at KPR Conversations, and you can also use our KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.